The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2014-1505 in the matter of the application of the Dayton Power and Light Company to establish a standard service offer in the form of an electric security plan, etc. For the appellant, we have Brady.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. I am appearing on behalf of the Ohio Consumers Council, the representative of nearly 500,000 DP&L residential customers. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This morning, I will limit my remarks to OCC Proposition of Law Number 1. I will explain how the PUCO violated the law when it charged customers a $330 million service stability rider. OCC will rely on its brief for its remaining propositions of law. We ask, Your Honors, that you reverse the PUCO in expeditious fashion to avoid or prevent customers from paying another $80 million in unlawful charges. Already, customers have paid nearly $250 million to BP&L since 2014, money that they are not likely to get back unless this court reconsiders its decisions that bar customers' refunds for past payments. In 2013, the PUCO allowed DP&L to charge its customers what it called a financial integrity charge. But that financial integrity charge was transition revenue or equivalent revenue that is not permitted under the law. The law precludes DP&L from charging customers for transition revenues or any equivalent revenues after 2005. DP&L's financial integrity charge is a transition charge by another name. These issues should be familiar to the court. Recently, the court reversed a similar PUCO order requiring customers to pay AEP for a stability charge, a charge that is no different than DP&L's stability charge. This court found that charge was an unlawful transition charge.
So if we follow that summarily, we would reverse on that issue.
That is correct, Your Honor. You would reverse on the—
And there's no difference at all?
There is no difference at all. Let's take a look at the facts of the AEP case. This court, when it decided the AEP transition charge case, said that you have to look at the nature of the charge being collected to determine whether the law is being broken. In the case below, the chief financial officer, Mr. Craig Jackson from DP&L, testified that DP&L was losing revenues. There were three reasons that DP&L was losing revenues, all related to generation competition. More customers were shopping. Therefore, DP&L's standard service offer revenues were down. DP&L was receiving declining revenues for wholesale generation capacity, and DP&L was receiving less revenues.
And that condition continues, does it not? Just recently, FERC got involved in some issues with respect to that?
Yes, Your Honor, that situation does continue. But what it shows, Your Honor, is that competition is working to the benefit of customers. It's lowering rates, and more customers are shopping. That's exactly what the General Assembly intended when it passed the law encouraging competition for the benefit of customers.
So when does this transition charge run out?
Under the law, Your Honor, 4928 38 states that the PUCO cannot authorize the receipt of transition revenues or any equivalent revenues after the market development period. The market development period ended for Dayton Power and Light in 2005. Customers after 2005, customers were not required to pay transition charges, but when the PUCO approved the financial integrity charge, it caused customers to pay transition revenues.
So when does that charge run out, though? That's my question, the financial integrity charge.
The financial integrity charge is paid by customers through the end of this year, that is the end of 2016. That's why it's so important, Your Honor, that we have an expeditious ruling by this court reversing the PUCO.
So unless we reverse ourselves in terms of following that case from the 50s on refunds, they will have collected most of this money, even if we find they were not entitled to it.
They
will have collected it and keep it.
That is correct, Your Honor. $250 million has been collected. Only $80 million remains to be collected from customers. That's why it's so important for this court to issue its decision expeditiously. In fact, it's very important, especially for customers, for instance, living in the city of Dayton, where the poverty level is 35.2%. Expeditious relief is needed. This court needs to reverse, and it should reverse because this case compels the same result as the AEP case. The factual similarities between AEP in this case are rather plain and rather astounding. DP&L's charge was called, they're both named quite similarly. DP&L's charge was the service stability rider, while AEP's charge was the revenue stability rider. One was RSR, one was SSR. Both utilities were propped up by this financial integrity charge. Customers were required to fund the transition charge to guarantee that the utilities would achieve a profit of 7 to 11%.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I'm over here at your right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you a question about that. You've answered Justice Pfeiffer, you say $250 million has already been collected, $8 million remains to be collected.
80.
80, okay, I thought you said 8.
Fair. I'm sorry, yes, okay. 80 million.
80, so that if we went upstairs this afternoon and issued an order, you're saying that that's really the value of this case is to stop the 80? Is the 250 gone forevermore?
Your Honors, unfortunately, I would believe it is unless this court reconsiders its past decision and it determines that KECO should no longer apply in a post-Senate Bill 221 environment. It has not done so far in the several appeals that have occurred since 221 was passed, but certainly we would welcome that type of ruling. It would be the just result of this case.
Is there no ability to post a bond in the event that Consumers Counsel could be correct at the outset or seek some review from PUCO in that regard?
Your Honor, the statute does require, this court has read the statute to require OCC to post a bond. We did apply for a stay in this proceeding. It was denied.
With a bond?
Your Honor, OCC is a state agency. It's very difficult, if not impossible, for OCC to post a bond. We are a state agency. We have limits. Had we had to post a bond in a case involving $330 million, we would have had to post a bond of somewhere between $8 or $9 million.
Don't we have a series of other cases in other areas of the law where we have held the state never asked to post a bond?
That is correct, Your Honor, and we have argued that there are provisions that exempt a state agency, a governmental agency, from posting a bond. We have argued that in many stays that we've requested from the court, but to no avail. So this does create a problem for us, and it is a continuing problem for us.
Did you say that the bond would be $8 or $9 million?
Approximately, yes, Your Honor, because the bond is set based on a percentage of the dollars that are at risk.
And you could put, for $8 million, you could postpone the collection of $330 million? Is that what you're suggesting?
Your Honor, that's my understanding approximately, although I did not run the numbers specifically for this case. But yes, a bond would require that much. And we are a state agency. We can't post an $8, $10 million bond, even a $1 million bond. It's just we cannot encumber the state in that respect. So we are without a remedy. So that's why it's really very important for this court, because AEP controls, because there's no difference between this case and AEP, that this court should expeditiously reverse. There's no reason and no difference between the AEP case and the case before us. With respect to the 338.
Counsel, you're well into your reserve time. You've got 20 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve my remaining 20 seconds for rebuttal.
All righty. Mr. Darr.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Members of the court, may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of Industrial Energy Users of Ohio, a trade association that participates in PUCO matters for large industrial and commercial customers. I'd like to reserve up to 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In the case below, the commission, as OCC has just pointed out, authorized transition revenue of $330 million. The authorization of that rate caused the plan itself to fail the market test by at least $250 million. And if you also allocate to the calculation the amounts that were added to the plan in the entry nunk-pro-tunk 2 days after the initial decision, you add at least another $64 million to the cost of the plan relative to what it would have been under a market rate offer. Because these are both errors on the part of the commission, we're asking the court to reverse and remand. As indicated by OCC, the problem here is time. And we are asking that you also include in your order a direction to the commission to immediately suspend the rider. Without that, the $80 million is at risk. And each day that this case goes by, each month that this case goes by, another $10 million is added to the pot.
Counsel, I guess I'd ask you the same question. I used the word forevermore. The 250 is gone. What do you see as the significance of this case for the future?
The significance of this case for the future is twofold. Number one, if the case is decided as the commission has ordered it, the rider itself, the language in section 4928.143b2d has absolutely no limits. The commission could authorize anything under the guise of it providing additional authority, that it has additional authority to authorize additional charges.
So I guess my direct question to you then is, for a precedential value, do we have the ability today to see that this doesn't happen again?
I believe so, Your Honor. Let's assume for a moment that this is, in fact, a transition revenue recovery. And I think under the CSP decision, that's pretty clear. And I'm not going to beat that horse any further than it is necessary to answer your questions about what's in the record. If that's the case, then the question becomes, very specifically, does Section 4928.143b2d, the section that the commission is relying upon, allow for the recovery of transition revenue? And the answer to that has to be unequivocally no, for three reasons. First of all, Section 4928.143bd is an exception to the rule that there should be a market or cost-based collection in the electric security plan. The electric security plan starts from the premise that we're going to use a market-based calculation for the rate of generation service. It then allows the commission to pile on additional layers or charges that would otherwise violate other sections of the code. And one of those sections is B2D. The constraint on the commission's actions, as this court found in the CSP case in 2011, is that any charge that the commission authorizes as an addition to the generation-related charges must fit in one of the categories under B2D.
But the commission said that this is identical to a standard service offer. That was their premise for authorizing this. They didn't authorize it as a transmission charge.
No, they did not authorize it as a transmission
charge. They said it was necessary to promote retail stability because some customers are switching out of Dayton and some are switching back. And
right.
So for the stability, this is necessary. And they said it went to the company's financial integrity, which would have been at risk. So that's why the commission authorized it.
Correct, Your Honor. What the commission was...
They're not characterizing it as a generation charge.
Actually, they did not characterize it as a generation charge. They referred to it variously as a transition charge, a financial stability charge, and a variety of other things. Noteworthy, Your Honor, and going back to where I started, is that B2D does not authorize a transition charge, a financial integrity charge. Those are all specific terms recognized by the code.
Does it offer a standard service offer?
The standard service offer is the electric security plan, Your Honor.
Okay.
And as a term of that, the question here is whether or not the commission can authorize the additional collection of transition revenue under a rider approved under B2D. Well, the problem that the commission faces here is that this court has already determined that there is a bar, absent the notwithstanding clause, which I think which is where we're headed, that there is a bar on the recovery of transition revenue under B2D. You held as much in the CSP case.
Was that specifically addressed in that case, though, the notwithstanding clause?
No, the majority opinion specifically exempted it out in, I believe, footnote 3. And said that issue's not before us yet.
So this is the issue before us now.
And that's the secondary issue that arises in this case. And the question then becomes whether or not the notwithstanding clause should be read in such a way as to allow the commission to recover transition revenue under B2D, under the guise, and I used the term that you used, under the guise that it is a stability charge allowed under the other section. Now, this court...
Which statute is later in time?
The later statute is B2D relative to 38, the statute that says no additional transition revenue. At the same time, however, that the legislature was passing B2D, it was also telling the commission in section 4928.141, No more transition allowances. And they're very specific about that. If the notwithstanding clause applies, then that clause that says you're not allowed to authorize additional transition revenue is meaningless. At the same time that the General Assembly was passing B2D, allowing for a stability rider, it was also providing a provision that says specifically you are not allowed to authorize generation-related non-bypassable charges. And there's a specific provision, prohibition of that in section 4928.02H. So we must be careful when we're carving out exceptions to look at the exceptions that the legislature carved out. And none of those exceptions speaks to an allowance for transition revenue or its equivalent. To answer the justice's question, that's how you reconcile the notwithstanding clause with the general operation of the statute. The point
Counsel,
here.
Did the commission rely on the notwithstanding clause?
It did not, Your Honor.
Did DP&L raise the notwithstanding clause?
Not before the commission, as far as I can tell. It only pops up in the first brief of DP&L and the commission to this court. Subsequently, and this is probably a good guide for the court, the commission has never relied on that when it has authorized other charges under subsequent plans or in prior plans.
So is your first position that was waived?
It was our first position that it was waived. And our second position is, read the statute for what it says, and it doesn't say that that the commission can authorize a transition rider under B2D. This notion of waiver obviously is a good procedural solution to the problem. Doesn't mean that we won't be back here arguing this again another day, but I think that you get to the same result either way.
Counsel, I've advocated all along that we should look at that case from the 50s, I think it is, that says this court can't authorize refunds and overturn that and authorize refunds.
We would have no problem with that.
No, I'm sure you wouldn't. My question is, though, this particular rider was called a financial stability rider?
Financial integrity charge.
Integrity charge. And I'm less familiar with the financial condition and rate of return for DP&L as I am with AEP, which is a larger company and is apparently sound as a rock. What's the situation with DP&L?
DP&L,
if we were to order a refund, would it put it in financial jeopardy?
I don't know that I can expressly answer that or explicitly answer that question. Yeah. The documentation put before the commission by the company was that its rate of return would be going down, and I believe DP&L laid out some of that in its brief. But there was no indication that there would be failure of service or anything even approaching that on the part of the company. When I asked in the hearing specifically, well, how would the company react if it didn't get the, what was referred to in the case, the SSR, they said they'd probably have to cut some costs. And that probably they would. But that doesn't mean that they're in a position where they could not perform. The only thing in the record, and I see that I've run out of time, but the only thing in the record that you can point to by DP&L is a number of relatively self-serving statements to the effect of, if we don't get all this money, something bad's going to happen.
Ms. Grady said that the DP&L witness said that they were losing money and they blamed it on the generation competition.
Yes, the reason why we construe this as a transition charge is that the losses were associated with lost revenues associated with switching, low capacity prices in the wholesale market. DP&L has generation that it sells into the market. It wasn't getting the kinds of returns it had previously been getting under regulated retail rates, and energy prices were down. Lo and behold, they weren't making the money that they had been used to.
Well, there's a difference between not making money and losing money.
I would characterize it as not making the money they were used to. This is a lost revenues case. That's the long and short of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Perucci.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Charlie Faruqi on behalf of the Dayton Power and Light Company. I'd like to start where my colleague, Mr. Darr, left off, and that is with regard to the facts that relate to the financial condition of the company, and then talk about the notwithstanding clause, if I might. The opinion and order of the commission included an explanation that the staff, as you understand in PUCO cases, the staff of the commission did its own investigation. And on page 20 of the order, it's in OCC's appendix at page 30, it explains the testimony of the staff witnesses that, quote, DP&L would have financial losses in several years without an SSR. This is not only a decreased revenue case, as was just represented to you. It is a case in which, absent this revenue, the company is actually losing money. We included on page 7 of our initial brief a chart that shows the evidence that we presented at trial that from 2013 through 2017, in every single year, the company would have a negative return on equity.
What return are you showing on equity right now? What's the return for the stockholders that you're showing?
I thought you might ask that, although it's not in the record. The latest reported figure to the commission for jurisdictional return is 7.1%, which is at the lower end of the range of 7 to 11% that the commission found to be appropriate. Absent the SSR charge, the money at issue here, of course, it would not be that, Your Honor.
What would it be without this charge?
Well, what we have in the record are the negative ROEs. It depends on what year. Generally, they ranged from about negative 1% to negative 4%. But that chart's on page 7 of our brief.
And in the industry, what's the norm right now?
Oh, it's all over the map. It depends on whether a company is a distribution company only or has generation and so on. I would be guessing if I gave you a range now.
Okay, but you're losing revenue because you can't sell the excess power at the rates, at the price that you expected.
That's part of the reason, yes. The market for power has been depressed, and DP&L is an integrated company, transmission,
which is good news for customers, but not so good for people who own generation facilities.
That's correct. And on page 22 of its order, the commission found that DP&L is an integrated company, and if one of the businesses, generation, suffers financial losses, it may impact the entire utility. You can't break out generation separately and say, well, that's just a generation problem. The distribution customers and the service to them suffers. It's the whole point of a stability charge. And finally, with regard to facts, the commission found at page 22 that the $110 million was the minimum amount necessary. DP&L had actually asked for more to maintain its financial integrity to provide service to its customers.
What kind of a dividend are DP&L paying?
None. It's not paid a dividend since, I believe, 2010.
So they are in a different position than from AEP, for
They're in
example.
Quite a different position. And with regard to AEP, Ms. Grady told you that the case is identical, and it's not. If you look at paragraph 37 of the court's opinion in the AEP case, the court said the critical problem is that the evidence relied upon by the commission to approve the RSR for AEP was evidence that AEP had submitted to support its two-tiered capacity pricing plan. When you look at paragraphs 7, 24, 26, and 34 through 37 of the AEP case, you see that the as your honors will recall, that case was recent. You see that it had a capacity case as well as the case that they're beating us with, if you will. And DP&L has no such issue. That's a distinction between DP&L's fact pattern, a company that needed this charge for financial integrity, and the AEP situation. Let me turn briefly to the notwithstanding argument, if I may, because I wanted to give you the best argument that I have for why the court should address the notwithstanding charge. Chief Justice O'Connor's opinion in the AEP case, the concurring and dissenting opinion in which Justice Lansinger joined, said that, used the phrase broadly worded language to describe that notwithstanding clause. If your honors look at a 2012 opinion of this court, it's in the Ohio neighborhood case that is cited in IEU's briefs. It's cited in their supplemental brief at page 18, for example. That was the case involving a short-term lender act, and in an opinion by Justice French, the court explained in paragraphs 34 and 35 what a notwithstanding clause is, how it overrides other statutes, and it said the notwithstanding clause, it's paragraph 35, indicates the General Assembly's intention that the statute take precedence over any contrary statute. And here, of course, we have a statute that reads notwithstanding any other provision in Title 49.
Mr. Faruqi, my first concern is whether that issue was waived below. The commission didn't rely on it. It seems no one argued it until the case got here. Why is that not waived?
For two reasons. What we have here, it was not addressed at the commission. It was not in our brief. It was not in the commission's brief. That's true. It's in our briefs to this court. It wasn't below. The reason it's not waived here is that what we have is the purest question of law. The court always says the plain meaning of a statute controls, and when you interpret or apply any statute, you have to apply all of the language of that statute. Now, Chief Justice O'Connor's opinion said she would have remanded the AEP case to the commission to address the notwithstanding argument. You could do that here, but it's going to be right back here in another case.
And Mr. Farooqui, if I heard you correctly, did you say that the characterization of this charge was for stabilization and providing certainty to provide retail service?
That's correct.
So that's within that with notwithstanding clause. I mean, if you look at the section we're talking about under subsection D, we have that is an appropriate charge, if it including accounting or deferral, including future recovery of deferrals, as would have the effect of stabilizing or providing certainty regarding electrical service. So in a sense, it seems that the commission has used the characterization within the statute, within the notwithstanding clause, and has already done that, even though it's not an issue that was specifically mentioned by either party.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see my time has expired, so I would close by elaborating on that answer briefly. This court does not need the expertise of the commission to apply a notwithstanding clause that, as Chief Justice O'Connor has said, is very broadly worded.
Well, don't you think we should give them the first opportunity and then we'll review what they do?
Respectfully, I would think not, Your Honor, for the reason that this is the purest question of law and that the agency expertise would be of no help to you in interpreting a clause like this, especially in light of this court's 2012 decision in the Ohio neighborhood case on such a clause.
Before you sit down, counsel, where do the rates for customers, for deep P&L customers, fit in compared to neighboring service around the state or the Cincinnati area and the Columbus area?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. They are a bit lower, Your Honor. The result of this case, this ESP case, was actually a rate decrease because of the blending of DP&L's rates with the competitive market rates. The rates actually went down.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McNamee.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tom McNamee here on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission. Your Honors, the commission felt that it had to approve this charge. This company was in trouble, and in the absence of this charge, it would have been showing losses. That's what the record reveals.
It would have what?
It would have been showing losses. That puts...
Well, but the next thing that happens is a healthy company comes along and acquires it, and maybe that's what should happen instead of the PUCO deciding to prop up a company that apparently is failing.
Actually, Dayton was acquired by another company several years ago. AES is the owner of the company now, and that didn't do anything for their financial situation.
AES being?
It's the holding company that owns Dayton Power and
DPL. So how's that holding company doing?
Pardon?
How's the holding company doing?
Not very well, as I understand it. The reality is what's been put in front of the commission, and that reality is that this company is not earning enough money in the absence of this charge to be able to assure that people are able to get adequate and reliable
service.
Counsel,
do you agree that this charge terminates at the end of this year?
Yes, it does.
So how are they going to prop up Dayton Power and Light after this charge is over? Are we going to have another charge?
Well, no, actually quite a number of things are contemplated to occur. Dayton Power and Light is not able at this point in time to sell its generation off. the debt structure does not permit Dayton to be able to do that as a practical matter. It's anticipated that those assets will be sold off next year, so the generation will hopefully be gone. There's been a new rate case filed at the commission. It's pending now to assure that the distribution rates that customers charge are being charged will be appropriate and compensatory, but not too high for customers. So
well,
it's
here's the problem.
Yes.
It's all over the news that wholesale price electricity is going down, right?
Yes, it is.
And rather dramatically, in fact. And the commission is sitting over there saying, well, we can't have the customers getting the benefit of that. We got to prop these companies up and keep them going. So,
Your Honor, this is an unusual situation. This is the last integrated utility in Ohio. Everyone else.
How long ago did the General Assembly tell them to get rid of their generation?
In Senate Bill 3, there was a provision that required utilities to sell off, to get rid of their generation.
When was that?
That was in 2000. Now,
this is
none of them did it.
This is 2016. 16
yes.
years later.
None of them did that.
They're having trouble because they didn't follow what the General Assembly told them to do 16 years ago.
The General Assembly subsequently changed its mind, and that statute was changed.
Imagine that.
never happened before, I'm sure. The General Assembly subsequently changed its mind, and now utilities are not required to sell off their generation, but the commission has been helping companies to move their generation out. All the companies have, in fact, moved their generation out. Dayton anticipates doing that next year. As I say, they can't do it now.
Mr. McNamee,
yes.
Would you agree with Mr. Faruqi that the notwithstanding clause issue is a pure question of law?
Yes.
And if we were to remand this case to the commission for its answer, would we be getting anything helpful?
I can't imagine that you would. I mean, tacitly, the commission has taken that view of the statute. They believe they have not just the ability, they believe they have the obligation to step into a situation as they view this situation. Step into a situation where the continued functioning of the distribution end of the business, the provision of service to everybody, whether you shop or not, is put at risk by the financial condition of the company. They're obligated to do that. The very first charge that's made under the 492802, the policy statute, is to assure the provision of reliable service. That, in the commission's view, was put at risk by the financial situation.
And can this amount be characterized as transition costs, as your colleague on the other side was suggesting?
We don't believe so. We believe this is a very different case from the AEP decisions that this court considered. In that pair of cases, you'll remember, the commission was about calculating a capacity charge, which is very directly related to generation, of course, and then assuring that the company received that, you know, first it was calculated in the one case and that rate then was applied in the second case. It was very much with a view towards trying to assure that the capacity was properly paid for. That's not this Dayton case at all. This Dayton case is focused on continuing to provide a sufficient amount of revenue for this company so that they can continue the normal functioning to, you know, restore service, to answer the call center, do all those normal things.
Mr. McNamee, in the modern history of this state, has any electricity customer failed to receive service because the power company got into financial difficulty?
I've done this for 30 years, and I've never known an instance where a major utility has shown losses. This is an unprecedented potential situation.
That wasn't my question.
No, the answer to your question, no. Not that I'm aware of. But we've never had this situation.
Does the commission really believe if this company is financially underwater that suddenly the power is going to be turned off? Don't they believe that somebody's going to come along and pick up the pieces, and it won't be DP&L anymore, it'll be something else?
The commission has an obligation to assure reliable service for everybody. It can't hope that will happen. It can't, hope for some deus ex machina kind of resolution. It needs, it believes, to be proactive, to take steps when it sees a problem coming down the pike. And the problem is quite obvious here. We've never had a major electric utility showing losses. That's unprecedented.
And that's because they kept the generation when they were supposed to dispose of it.
All the utilities kept their generation at that point in time. None of them sold it off at that point. The law at that time allowed the commission to grant exceptions, and it granted exceptions to all.
But that wasn't obviously a smart business plan, was it?
It worked fine for years.
We're only talking 16 years here, and how long legislature repeal the mandate?
That would have been about 8 years ago, I believe.
Okay, so for 8 years, everybody else jettisoned their generation except for
some quite recently. I believe AEP did it last year. Duke did it the year before that.
But they weren't struggling the way Dayton Power and Light is. So I look at this and I think, they didn't make some very good choices.
In retrospect, that may be true, but Dayton was very successful and financially sound up until very recently. You could almost watch their financial situation deteriorate while the case was going on.
When was charge initiated?
It would have been 2.5 years ago, I believe.
So they were struggling before that. They'd have to be in order to decide that we need to, put
somewhat
this major charge.
But again, at that point, there were no other real alternatives available. They can't sell off their generation.
Why can't they sell off their generation?
The debt structure is such that the debt is not callable, but it's secured by all of the assets. So in order to refinance that debt, you need to get the approval of the debt holders. You can't call it. You can't require them to sell the debt off. So that goes away. The debt comes due next year. So in 2017, they anticipate selling off their generation. But
so
they can't do it now because the debt.
In the event that we permit collection of the rest of this money by Dayton Power and Light as of January 1, 2017, there is no additional supplement. Is that right?
Not at this point in time. Is there
an application pending to continue
there
this?
There is an application pending.
To continue this supplement with the PUCO?
That is what the company has sought. What the commission does, it's still an open question. So there is that case that's pending. There's also the rate case.
So if they anticipate that they're going to sell off their generation in 2017.
Yes.
Okay. But they still need to be propped up. That's what they're telling the PUCO?
I believe that to be the case. I'm not involved in that case directly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counselor, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, 2 points. One, customers paid in 2000 $441 million in transition charges to this company. That was supposed to be the end of the transition charge. That $441 million was supposed to be the revenue requirements associated with DP&L's power plants for the period of 2000 through 2030.
Did your agency concur in that resolution?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. We were part of that settlement, but that was a one and out.
So what were the terms of the settlement in terms of future revenue to DP&L?
Your Honor, I'm not quite familiar with the terms at this point, but I would not believe that the terms included the ability to come again before the commission and ask for additional stranded investment.
When was the 441?
The 441 began to be collected in 2000, was to cover the revenue requirements for DP&L's power plants for a 30-year period.
So they were going to collect it for a 30-year period, or they just...
The revenue requirement was associated with a 30-year revenue requirement that was collected in less than 30 years.
Okay.
So now we've passed the market development period. It's past 2005. Customers already paid once. If you construe the notwithstanding language, customers will have to pay again. That's an unreasonable construction of the law. The second point is on financial integrity. The commission is a creature of statute. It cannot do anything more than the law allows. There is no financial integrity provision found under 4928.143b. If we look at the MRO statute, the market rate offer statute, yes, financial integrity is a provision. It is something that the commission can consider. But on an ESP, there is no financial integrity provision.
Counsel, so I understand where you're going then. If you're saying the charge or the rate never should have been authorized, are you therefore on board with saying if we reverse it today, reverse the 50s, and put Dayton Power and Light in financial peril, that's okay?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that this utility has the power under an ESP to reject any modifications. It can protect its own financial integrity. If the commission modifies its ESP, it can withdraw and terminate. It has that power. It also has the power, if the commission orders a significantly excessive earnings adjustment, to terminate and withdraw. It doesn't need any more power. The statute does not allow what the commission did here. The commission is a creature of statute.
You're saying that this is not a charge under D? You're saying it does not have the effect of stabilizing or providing certainty regarding retail electrical service.
While it may have that effect, Your Honor, that's only one part of the three-part provision that it must meet. It must be a term and condition, and we don't disagree that it is a term and condition, but then it must fit within the categories of cost. And there is no, under that section, there is no category of cost that says financial integrity. And then the third provision is, as you point out, that it stabilizes or provided certainty. We're skipping one provision altogether because it just does not fit. There is nothing in the statute that requires or that allows a financial integrity charge. It's not default service. It's not related to bypassability. It doesn't fit within the statute. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, I think you've used your time, too. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, just 2 points. Number one, what's in the pipeline and why this case is important? Dayton has filed a case for a new ESP to begin next summer. That case includes a stability rider of $137 million. The rider is calculated by the amounts that it will not recover in the marketplace. The opening value of it is $137 million. They claim over the life of the plan.
Is that what Mr. McEnany was talking about?
Yes.
That's the next ask of the PUCO.
The next ask is $137 million in the first year. Now, they claim that the rider will flip because they anticipate market prices will themselves flip. And over the life of the rider, it shows a positive benefit. But the opening ask is $137 million.
So is that why this is an important case? That's why this is an important case today.
They've asked for authority.
Dealing with the future.
They've asked for authority. Well, it's important because of the $80 million that's at stake now. It's important because of the effects it will have on future cases that are pending before the commission as we stand here, including one involving Dayton Power and Light.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.